and welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I will be covering six of the most exciting abstracts that were presented at the third day of the American College of Congress, which was held virtually from the 28th through the 30th of March, 2020. So I'm going to start off with the TICO trial, T-I-C-O, which was presented by Professor Yang-Soo Jang at Yonsei University in South Korea. Now, the purpose of this trial was to investigate ticagrelor monotherapy after 3 months of dual antiplatelet therapy versus ticagrelor-based 12-month dual antiplatelet therapy for patients with acute coronary syndrome after percutaneous coronary intervention with new-generation drug-eluting stents. So the study enrolled 3,065 acute coronary syndrome patients, and the mean age was 61 years. They underwent PCI with the second-generation ultra-thin biodegradable polymer-coated sirolimus-eluting stents. All the patients received ticagrelor plus aspirin for 3 months, after which they were randomized to continue treatment with ticagrelor alone monotherapy, and there was 1,527 patients in that cohort, or ticagrelor with aspirin, and it was 1,529 patients in that group. So pretty evenly balanced. The primary study endpoint was a net clinical benefit composite of death, myocardial infarction, stroke, stent thrombosis, revascularization, or thrombolysis and myocardial infarction, major bleeding at 12 months. The results, they showed that 3.9% of the patients on the ticagrelor monotherapy reached the primary endpoint compared with 5.9% of the patients continuing the dual antiplatelet therapy. And that gave a p-value of 0.01 and a hazard ratio of 0.66. So interestingly, there was a clear difference in the event rate at 3 months after randomization, with 1.4% of the ticagrelor monotherapy patients achieving the composite endpoint versus 3.5% of the patients on dual antiplatelet therapy. No difference was observed in ischemic events between the two groups, although the study had some limitations, like the open-label design, and there was no placebo group used, and there were patients excluded that had an elevated risk for bleeding for other reasons. It was, however, concluded that the ticagrelor monotherapy does seem to be the optimal strategy regimen, balancing both ischemic and bleeding risks for patients with acute coronary syndrome. The next interesting talk was a sub-study presented by Professor George Dangus from the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in the United States, and it was a sub-study of the Twilight Complex trial, and the purpose of this sub-study was to evaluate the effect of ticagrelor monotherapy versus ticagrelor with aspirin in patients undergoing complex percutaneous coronary intervention, which was defined as a combination of high-risk angiographic and procedural features. So the data was obtained from the 2,342 participants that were from the Twilight trial, which was really large, conducted at 187 sites in 11 countries. After 3 months of the ticagrelor with aspirin, the event-free patients were continued to receive ticagrelor and were randomized to either aspirin or placebo for an additional year. And the participants underwent complex PCI, defined as any of the following. So there were either three vessels treated or more than three lesions treated, or the total stent length was exceeded 60 millimeters, or there was bifurcation with two stents implanted, or a thoracotomy device use, or left main PCI was also included, surgical bypass graft, or chronic total occlusion as target lesions. So bleeding and ischemic endpoints were evaluated 1 year after randomization. So the ticagrelor and placebo resulted in significantly lower rates of bleeding, according to the BARC type 2, type 3, or 5 scales. And that was more than the ticagrelor plus aspirin. That was 4.2% versus 7.7% respectively, and that gave a hazard ratio of 0.54. So BARC type 3 or BARC 5, a type 5 bleeding, was also significantly reduced with ticagrelor plus placebo, 1.1%, versus ticagrelor plus aspirin, and that was 2.6%, with a hazard ratio of 0.41. So no significant between group differences were observed in death or myocardial infarction or stroke. And the same was true for the stent thrombosis. So in conclusion, this Twilight Complex substudy really showed that a regimen of ticagrelor monotherapy after an initial 3 months of dual antiplatelet therapy with ticagrelor plus aspirin to treat patients who underwent complex percutaneous coronary intervention in a high-risk population was associated with a significantly lower clinically relevant bleeding without increasing the risk of ischemic events compared with continuing the dual antiplatelet therapy. Moving on to some interventional cardiology, the EXPAND study was next on my list. And the EXPAND study looked at the safety and efficacy of the next generation mitral clip, NTR and XTR system, which is used in primary mitral regurgitation patients in the real world setting. And Professor Scott Lim from the University of Virginia in the United States presented this study and looked at the large 1,000-plus patient global EXPAND study, which was really the first to represent contemporary reporting of the ECHO Core Lab and Clinical Events Committee adjudicated 30-day clinical outcomes in patients with primary mitral regurgitation, who were treated with the next-generation NTR and XTR mitral clips. So apart from reporting the real-world outcomes, the secondary objectives of the study were to evaluate mitral regurgitation reduction outcomes as a function of mitral valve anatomic complexity and to confirm the safety, including the single leaflet device attachments and leaflet injuries, and efficacy of mitral regurgitation, which was associated with the NTR and XTR systems. So eligible patients had symptomatic mitral regurgitation as assessed by more than three sites, and they provided consent for study participation, of course, and were eligible to receive the mitral clip according to the currently approved indications for use in their respective geographies. So the overall study subject population was 413 subjects with a secondary mitral regurgitation etiology and 422 subjects with a primary or mixed etiology. And this last group, the 422 patients, is the focus of this sub-study. So all-cause death occurred in this subgroup in 2.4% of patients and stroke in 1.2% of patients. Non-elective cardiovascular surgery for device-related complications was 0.9%, so nearly 1%. With regard to the device-related leaflet adverse events, single leaflet device attachment occurred in 1.9% of the patients and leaflet injury in 0.2% of the patients. So it was concluded that approximately one-third of patients had a complex mitral valve anatomy, which reflects the difference in patients treated in the real world versus the comparison with previous clinical trials. However, the results showed that mitral regurgitation in fewer than one site was being achieved more often with the MitraClip NTR and XTR than previously observed in the Everest II trials. So MitraClip XTR was associated with greater mitral regurgitation reduction compared with the NTR in more complex anatomies. That's also important to note. So I think overall that the EXPAND study really confirmed the safety and efficacy of the next generation MitraClip NTR and XTR systems in primary mitral regurgitation patients in the real world setting. And it's very exciting news. The next talk I chose was the phase 2 MAVERICK-HCM trial. And that was an interesting trial that was presented by Dr. Carolyn Ho from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in the United States. And this trial looked at mavacamten in patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And its primary point was some efficacy data and, of course, safety data. So mavacamten, it's a really interesting drug because it's a first-in-class selective allosteric inhibitor of cardiac myosin, which reduces the number of myosin-actin crossbridges that decreases the excessive contractility that characterizes hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So the study analyzed 59 patients with symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and after a 28-day screening period, the patients were assigned to either once-daily mavacamten with a drug concentration target of either 200 nanograms per milliliter or once daily mavacamten with a drug concentration target of 500 nanograms per milliliter versus a placebo group. So all those groups were about 20 individuals, evenly distributed with very similar baseline characteristics. The patients were treated during a period of 16 weeks, and then there was a followed by a monitoring for an additional 8 weeks after completion. So during the treatment and washout period, up to 24 weeks in any case, nearly 90% of the patients who received mavacamten had more than one treatment-emergent adverse event, most of which were mild. However, nearly 70% of the patients on placebo also had one, so it was an increase, but not huge. Furthermore, 10.3% of the mavacamten patients had serious adverse events versus more than 20% with the placebo, so in that case there were fewer adverse events. Mean reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction from baseline to 16 weeks in the pooled in the mavacamten group was for the lower dose mavacamten, 200 nanograms per milliliter, a reduction of 2.3%. Yet for those in the higher dose group, 500 nanograms per milliliter mavacamten, it was reduced by 5.6%. So more than twofold, nearly threefold. And for the placebo, it was similar to the low-dose mavacamten and with a reduction of 2.3%. So also, they produced some biomarker data. The mavacamten reduced N-terminal pro-brain natriuretic peptides by 53%, and the placebo only had 1% reduction. So that is a very significant number of p-value of 0.0005. The drug also decreased cardiac troponin by 34% versus a 4% increase in the placebo, and that's a p-value of 0.009. So the change in the natriuretic peptides at 4 weeks in patients assigned to mavacamten, it really did correlate with the change in cardiac troponin at 16 weeks with a p-value of 0.006. So the take-home message from the MAVERICK-HCM trial really shows that treatment with mavacamten in patients at both doses was really well tolerated, and it reduced the biomarkers of cardiac injury and wall stress. So exciting news. Looking forward to more data on that. The next talk I chose was the phase 2 MAVERICK-HCM trial, and that was an interesting trial that was presented by Dr. Carolyn Ho from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in the United States. And this trial looked at mavacamten in patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and its primary point was some efficacy data and, of course, safety data. So mavacamten, it's a really interesting drug because it's a first-in-class selective allosteric inhibitor of cardiac myosin, which reduces the number of myosin-actin crossbridges that decreases the excessive contractility that characterizes hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So the study analyzed 59 patients with symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and after a 28-day screening period, the patients were assigned to either once-daily mavacamten with a drug concentration target of either 200 nanograms per milliliter or once daily mavacamten with a drug concentration target of 500 nanograms per milliliter versus a placebo group. So all those groups were about 20 individuals evenly distributed with very similar baseline characteristics. The patients were treated during a period of 16 weeks, and then there was a followed by a monitoring for an additional 8 weeks after completion. So during the treatment and washout period, up to 24 weeks in any case, nearly 90% of the patients who received mavacamten had more than one treatment-emergent adverse event, most of which were mild. However, nearly 70% of the patients on placebo also had one, so it was an increase, but not huge. Furthermore, 10.3% of the mavacamten patients had serious adverse events versus more than 20% with the placebo, so in that case, there were fewer adverse events. Mean reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction from baseline to 16 weeks in the pooled, in the mavacamten group was for the lower dose mavacamten, 200 nanograms per milliliter, a reduction of 2.3%. Yet for those in the higher dose group, 500 nanograms per milliliter mavacamten, it was reduced by 5.6%. So more than twofold, nearly threefold. And for the placebo, it was similar to the low dose mavacamten and with a reduction of 2.3%. So also, they produced some biomarker data. The mavacamten reduced N-terminal pro-brain natriuretic peptides by 53%, and the placebo only had 1% reduction. So that is a very significant number of p-value of 0.0005. The drug also decreased cardiac troponin by 34% versus a 4% increase in the placebo, and that's a p-value of 0.009. So the change in the natriuretic peptides at 4 weeks in patients assigned to mavacamten, it really did correlate with the change in cardiac troponin at 16 weeks with a p-value of 0.006. So the take-home message from the MAVERICK-HCM trial really shows that treatment with mavacamten in patients at both doses was really well tolerated, and it reduced the biomarkers of cardiac injury and wall stress. So exciting news. Looking forward to more data on that. Next, evinicumab was looked at in patients with homozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, and this was a phase 3 trial, small but significant given the rare nature of these patients. This was presented by Dr. Frederick Rahal from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, and he presented the results of this study, which explained that evinicumab, it's a fully human monoclonal antibody inhibitor of the ANGPTL3, and it reduces LDL-C regardless of the LDL receptor. So patients were eligible if they were 12 years or older and on a stable maximally tolerated lipid-lowering therapy. with cholesterol of greater than 70 milligrams per deciliter despite that treatment. So participants were randomized at that point to evinacumab, 15 milligrams per kilogram administered IV every 4 weeks. There were 43 patients in that group, or a placebo, which was at 22 patients in that group. The primary endpoint of the study was LDL cholesterol reduction from baseline at 24 weeks. So after 20 weeks of follow-up, the mean LDL reduction was 47.1% in patients in the evinacumab arm, compared with an increase of 1.9% in the placebo arm. So this translated to an average relative reduction of 49% in the patients receiving evinacumab, meeting the trial's primary endpoint with a p-value of less than 0.001. For patients who received evinacumab, the LDL reductions were similar to those with the null-null alleles, so complete loss of function, and there were 15 patients in that group, as well as the non-null-null mutations, so that would mean where one allele was a null allele and the other one had some function residually retained. And there were 28 patients in that group, so there were no differences. It didn't make a difference as long as one of the alleles was a so-called null allele. That was enough to see this effect. At 24 weeks, the absolute change in LDL was 134.7 milligrams per deciliter for patients receiving evinacumab versus 2.6 milligrams per deciliter for those on placebo, and that was a p-value of 0.0001. So adverse events occurred in 65.9% of the evinacumab patients. You know, it is a monoclonal antibody, but there are even more adverse events in the placebo patients at 81%. But serious adverse events occurred in 4.5% of evinacumab patients, while no placebo patients experienced serious adverse events. So according to the researchers, the events occurring in the evinacumab group were unrelated to the study drug, but you know, several study limitations still were observed, including the duration of the period, particularly for conclusions regarding the long-term safety of evinacumab. The safety of evinacumab is being further assessed in the open-label treatment period of this trial. So I think we can conclude that the results of this phase 3 trial really did demonstrate a promising role for evinacumab to substantially lower the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol in patients with homozygous familial hypocholesterolemia. Lastly, a really interesting study was a follow-up on the REDUCE-IT trial. It was presented by Dr. Deepak Bhatt at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in the United States. And this sub-study looked at the serum levels of eicosapentaenoic acid in the patients that were included in the REDUCE-IT trial. So this initial study, that was 8,179 patients at 473 sites in 11 different countries, and all the patients had elevated cardiovascular risk and were on statins. So they were randomized to icosapent ethyl, either 4 grams per day, and there were over 4,000 patients in that group, or placebo. So both arms had about 4,100 patients. And there was a mean duration of 4.9 years of follow-up. So a lot of people have been waiting for the study because eicosapentaenoic acid, it's an essential omega-3 fatty acid and a major ingredient in fish oil. Dietary levels of this would not be achieved given the regimen. So results showed that the eicosapent ethyl 4 grams daily compared to the placebo resulted in a reduced combined rate of first and subsequent non-fatal myocardial infarction, stroke, cardiovascular death, coronary revascularization, or hospitalizations for unstable angina by 25% and 30% respectively. So the eicosapentaenoic acid levels were measured and compared with the placebo group after this period of time. And the patients were grouped by tertiles ranging from the lowest to the highest levels of eicosapentaenoic acid levels, and they were averaged across visits. So the results actually suggested that the achieved eicosapentaenoic acid levels in the serum was strongly associated with cardiovascular events. Each group of patients showed significant relative risk reduction in cardiovascular events. So significant associations were found with all measured cardiovascular outcomes in this trial, and it emerged that the higher the serum eicosapentaenoic acid level was, the lower the rate of the various cardiovascular events, cardiovascular deaths, and even total mortality. So overall, the drug significantly increased serum eicosapentaenoic acid levels by 386%, so fourfold, from the baseline to 1 year when compared with placebo. So there was seems to be no observed role in other elements of the omega-3 fatty acids, and they were considered, it was really purely considered to be the result of the eicosapentaenoic acid serum levels. Also, patients who had the highest on-treatment eicosapentaenoic levels actually had significant reduction in hospitalizations for new onset of heart failure with the drug compared to the placebo. Furthermore, significant associations were observed between the on-treatment EPA levels and a lower risk for sudden cardiac death and cardiac arrest. So the conclusion from this study really was that these are exciting findings, which may open a whole new field of study and actually might be a very, very reasonable treatment option in the future going forward. Thank you so much for listening to us today.